Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, my name is Victor, and I'll be your host tonight on MLB Central. And on the last day of franchise four building, I will delve into the candidates and give my own opinion. Fans, remember, you too can be a part of the show if you call in at 516-666-9990 or enter our chat room at www.blogtalkradio.com/MLB Central. On this day in baseball history, in 1878, Providence Gray outfielder Paul Hines becomes the first player to execute an unassisted triple play after making a shoestring catch in left field, center field, and stepping on third, retiring both runners who had passed the base. The runners were out due to the rules used at the time. And now it's time for the random player of the day. All right, fans, here are your clues. His real first name is Henry. His middle name is Lewis. His nicknames are Hammer, Hammer and Hank, or Bad Henry. Positions right fielder and first baseman. That's right, throws right, height 6 feet, weight 180 pounds, born February 5th, 1934 in Mobile, Alabama. High school, Allen Institute, signed as a free agent with the Boston Braves in 1952. Debut April 13th, 1954, versus Cincinnati, 5 at bats, no hits, no home runs, no RBIs, no stolen bases. Rookie status, exceeded rookie limits during 1954 season. Teams, Braves, Brewers, 1954 to 1976. Last game, October 3rd, 1976, versus Detroit. One hit, no home runs, one RBI, no stolen bases. And that's in the Hall of Fame by BBWAAS player in 1982. View Hank Aaron Page at the Baseball Hall of Fame. Relatives, brother of Tommy Aaron. View player bio from the Favorite Bio Project. His numbers were 5, 44, 44, 44, 44, 44, and 44. Again, his teams were the Braves and the Brewers. Now it's time for the All-Star Game debate of the day. All-Star Game debate. Jones to Ellsbury and Center. Candidates from American League East have impressive early season stats. We'll be doing All-Star Game daily All-Star Game debates until balloting ends on July 2nd. We will be frequently hitting one against another, and have Will or I make a case for one of them. But that doesn't mean there aren't any other good candidates for that position. In fact, your call at 516-666-9990 or enter our chat room at www.blogtalkradio.com/MLBCentral could spark a new debate for us to tackle, so let us know what you think. Sometimes it's pretty obvious who the All-Star should be at a given position. Talking about the center fielders in the American League is not one of those times. In Kansas City, Lorenzo Cain helped the Royals make it to the World Series for the first time in 3 decades last season. And Anaheim, that Mike Trout kid, has a 2014 AL Most Valuable Player Award. And that's even before we get to the task at hand. Choosing between the Orioles is Adam Jones and Jacoby Ellsbury of the Yankees. Both of them are off to a terrific start. Abstaining is not an opinion, apparently. Not just picking names out of the hat. Choosing alphabetically or claiming to have a headache. So let's get on with weighing the merits of the two AL East candidates. Look at Ellsbury's numbers, especially the .438 on base percentage and the .853 OPS going into Friday night. In an era where few teams have a classic leadoff hitter, they are impressive, even more so when you consider that he was hitting just .263 through the first 2 weeks of the season. Since April 18th, though, Ellsbury has been one of the hottest hitters in baseball. Unbelievable, said Yankees manager Joe Girardi. Ellsbury's fast, as evidenced by 11 stolen bases. His proficiency, teaming up with Brett Gardner at the top of the order, is a big reason why the Yankees may have surprised many by being in first place. Still, the pick is Jones. The tipping point here is simply the role that each player has. As important as cable setters are, Jones is a middle-of-the-order power plant. Like Ellsbury, he's hitting for a high average and it's an OBP over 400. Unlike Ellsbury, Jones also hits for power, which has given him an OPS. Another way, Jones has scored or driven in 33 of the 126 runs, 26.2%. He hasn't scored. He also has 4 Gold Gloves awards, although it's true that he hasn't ranked as highly when evaluated by modern defensive metrics. Jones is showing improved play discipline this season. He plays nearly every day. And while there's a difference between deciding who should be on the All-Star team and picking the Most Valuable Player Award winner, there's no question that Jones has become the player the Orioles' clubhouse revolves around. In fact, around Baltimore, the question isn't so much whether he should be the starting center fielder of the All-Star game, as whether Jones has a chance to be the O's first AL MVP award winner since Cal Ripken in 1991. It's still early yet, of course. Statistics can change in a hurry. It would be a mistake to lose sight of Trout. Here's the thing, though. Jones has been really good for a while now when he's in the prime of his career. has been an all-star each of the last three seasons, Jones should make it four in a row this shot because nobody is having a better year. Right, we're going to give you a brief outline of the franchise for candidates since this is last day, 11:15 at Tammy Sharon, submit your votes. So the candidates that we'll be talking about and that you can vote for are Hank Aaron, Johnny Bench, Barry Bonds, Ricky Henderson, Pedro Martinez, Willie Mays, and Tom Stewart. So we're going to start today by discussing Hank Aaron and Hank Aaron's greatness and duels. The humble legend that is Hank Aaron moves around this town and others with folks whispering and pointing in his direction. It makes you feel good, he said, with his distinctive baritone chuckle. They don't know I can hear them, but some people will say, is that really Hank Aaron? I thought he was dead. That chuckle evolved into a roaring laugh. At 81, Aaron's knees are creaky and so are his hips, but he is alive and mostly well, thank you. Which brings us to this. When voting on MLB.com ends for Friday for baseball's greatest living players, Aaron's name will rank near the top. And the results released earlier this week, Aaron had the highest vote total. They called me last week from the baseball commissioner's office to give me an indication that things were going in that direction, Aaron said. His long-time home in Atlanta, where his post-playing career with the Braves has become nearly as prolific as his 23 base, 755 career homers, Aaron never struck out more than 100 times during the season. He won three gold gloves in right field during the era of Roberto Clemente. He also wasn't a snail in spikes. I didn't have the stolen base marshals Lou Brock. That was an Olympic head spinner. But I'll tell you this. I could steal whenever I got ready, Aaron said, referring to his success rate of 70%, 240 steals out of 311 attempts. In case you're wondering, Brock was successful 69% of the time, with 938 steals out of 1,245. How huge is Aaron's legacy? Well, he had his picture hung last year in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery. And who else can you name with three statues of himself in three different cities? He has one in Atlanta, Turner Field. He has another one at Norm Park in Milwaukee, where he began his major league career in 1954 with the Braves. They moved south in 1966, and where he retired a decade later with the Brewers. He also has a statue in New Clare, Wisconsin, where he started his pro baseball career. In addition, the minor league stadium in Aaron's hometown of Mobile, Alabama, is named in his honor. City officials even turned his boyhood house into a museum, and it next to the ballpark. When they moved that house from its original spot, well, which is very sad seeing your house in which you were born traveling down the highway, Aaron said, shaking his head. As for me, my parents, and all of my siblings, eight of us, were born. Aaron's become so many things since his Alabama days of poverty and segregation. Eventually, he is a Braves executive. He was the hidden force behind the franchise winning a record 14 consecutive division titles through the early 21st century. Because he was the farm director in the 1980s, when the nucleus for those teams was built, unofficially, he is the reincarnation of the hero, Jackie Robinson Jr., who spent his baseball years championing the cause for African Americans in the game beyond the playing field. Aaron has done the same, and he often has done so as a singular voice. There was the aftermath of Robinson's death in October 1972, when Aaron urged Ernie Banks, Willie Mays, and other prominent African American players to be just as vocal and follow in Robinson's footsteps. Those players were more hesitant. Aaron shrugged with memory. Then recalled how he didn't beg them to reconsider. I realized the players you just mentioned had other things. Their agenda was made up of other things, Aaron said. My agenda was made up of something that, well, I think God had given me the talent to play baseball. And I'd show my people I could play baseball. But I also had other things God had given me. There's the way Aaron has dedicated himself to improving the lives of disadvantaged kids. I can see children in Chicago, and they know who I am, said Aaron. That really makes me feel good. It's not the home runs or whatever success I had in baseball. It's what I do today. It's what Henry has done lately. And the foundation I built has really helped me with that because I'm so close to the children. About that foundation, it's called the Chase of the Dream Foundation. And Aaron and his wife, Billy, have operated for decades to help gifted, yet financially challenged youth throughout the nation pursue their passions in life with scholarships. Along with Aaron, the philanthropist, there's Aaron, the entrepreneur, featuring a financial profile that has included everything from car dealerships to food franchises. I also feel extremely lucky that I serve on five or six different boards across the country, Aaron said. I try to keep myself as active as I possibly can. Maybe too active. My wife and I talk about this all the time, and she says, what do you think we should do in the future? I don't know, but I'm not ready to retire. And she's not ready to retire, so we stay active. Just last Saturday, the Aaron flew to Louisville for the first trip to the Kentucky Derby. Soon after they landed back in Atlanta Sunday morning, They were on the road to Nashville for a speaking gig. All on the way, Aaron was hugged, applauded, and revered by nearly everybody in his vicinity. This was the antithesis of what he experienced more than four decades ago while battling the combination of pictures, death threats, and hate mail during his successful pursuit of Babe Ruth's career home run total of 714. Barry Bonds later topped Aaron's mark with 752. But what Bonds accomplished deserves an asterisk, courtesy of his reported PED. All the things we're talking about now, such as do they recognize you? Do they know who you are? I'll tell you, I'm 81 years old, and as much as you try to say you need your privacy, you want people to recognize you, Aaron said. I go back to places like Milwaukee, I go to Seattle, and the first thing people start doing is talking about baseball. Oh, I remember when you did this and that, when we won the World Championship for the Braves in 1957. They remember more going back to those days than I do. Another chuckle. That's good. It makes you know you did things people enjoy. Aaron continued to do such things. You know, enough of them remain pure as someone's peers who are still breathing. Aaron, now we're going to move on to the candidacy for Johnny Bench. RJ's Norm Clark honored by Denver Press Club. Damon Runyon would have loved the characters at a party held in his honor the other night in Denver. The occasion was the Denver Press Club's 21st annual Damon Runyon Award banquet. Runyon, a DPC member, rose from a Colorado sports writer to a star reporter with United Press and later a legendary New York newspaperman. His short stories became an inspiration for the Broadway hit musical Guys and Dolls. The dinner was held at the same downtown Marriott that hosted UNLV fans during the 1990 Final Four. The rafters are still vibrating decades later. The good folks of Denver invited me back to accept the Runyon Award on Friday. Denver Mayor Michael Hancock threw in Norm Clark Day one moment. Governor John Hickenlooper, a friend long before he left his brew pub for politics, rehashed my pass at the podium. This was my fourth Runyon dinner, the first since 1996 when I met Herb Cain, San Francisco's legendary three-dot columnist. He was dying from cancer, but still showed up. In my introductory video, the Runyon crowd was invited to join me for a night of relish swashbuckling. Many took me upon it. Did they ever? When the after-party moved across town to the press club, included in this cast of eight guys of Guys and Dolls were names like Irish Johnny, Moose, Dinger, Tossie, and of course the ubiquitous Leggy Bonds. Irish Johnny, a Las Vegas bartender who knows how to get a party started, and was holding court from behind the bar. Old habits die hard. Until someone suggested he join his new friends on their side of the bar. Unrepentant, he soon recruited most of the remaining women to join him in a tipsy. Tossie left Coruscant in the oldest press club in the U.S., incorporated in 1877. What a night. Turns out Irish Johnny wasn't the only Las Vegas connection. The club's designated photographer, who doubled as our designated driver, asked the Leggy Blonde if she knew a singer named Clint Holmes. The man asking, longtime press club member Dick Nosbusch, was a drummer in Holmes' first band in upstate New York in 1964, before fame came calling for Holmes. On the press club wall was a framed photograph of burlesque queen Tempest Storm, now 87 and living in Las Vegas. In the 1960s photo, she was being interviewed at a newsroom desk in the Rocky Mountain News. She was a fugitive, the story said. An arrest warrant had been issued for her failure to appear in court. For sin, she had jaywalked on the way from the Brown Palace Hotel to a restaurant across the street. Thank you, Denver, for the many friendships and memories in a Runyon-esque world. Norm Clark's column appears Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Reach him at 702-383-0244 or norm@reviewjournal.com. Find more at normclark.com. Follow at norm_clark on Twitter. Norm Clark's Damon Runyon Award speech. Wow. What a fancy crowd. That's something like those Vegas parties where, if you're invited, you're invited. Earlier, we spent some time at the press club. It reminded me that my favorite, there was not a bar, like some of you would have guessed. It was NEC in the caricature room. I always loved being in there. Seeing those faces on that wall of fame was pure inspiration. Rocky columnist Gene Amol, who fought in the Battle of the Bulge. Post-political cartoonist Paul Conrad, who went to the LA Times and won the Pulitzer Prize. They left an indelible imprint. As inspirational as that room was, nothing topped the night in 1996 when the Runyon receptionist for Molly Ivins and my first journalist hero, Herb Kane. I'm incredibly honored and grateful to be here tonight. Journalism changed my life and opened my world. It was so improbable that I would have this career. At age 10, I lost my father. Months later, I lost my aunt. I spent much of my teen years angry and unfocused. My first job in my early teens was as a newspaper boy. I read the Miles City Star from cover to cover as I walked my route. I daydreamed that I could someday live out the adventures on those pages. Like every other kid in my small Montana hometown, I wanted to be part of the Terrier sports legacy. At age 15, I assumed I was going to play football. My mother, my eye doctor, and my coach disagreed with me. It was devastating being relegated to the sidelines. Being excluded and marginalized really hurt. As much as I wanted to play football, being accepted meant even more. Well, I finally warmed down and got to play my junior and senior seasons. It was life-changing to excel at something. But I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and quickly flunked out of college. I returned to my hometown, population 600. I was back to square one. I got a job at a grocery store, and something incredible happened. My big break came when I walked across the street and delivered an ad to our weekly newspaper. Because I was such a sports fanatic, I asked the editor if he was planning to attend the basketball tournament. He wasn't, but he said, "Why don't you cover it?" I leaped at the opportunity. I was hooked. When I turned in my game story, the editor gave it a quick read, took out a checkbook, and paid me. It was for the princely sum of $5. That was the best day of my life, because at that moment, I realized I could do what I loved and get paid for it. My first mentor was my first sports editor, Gordy Spear. Gordy became my father figure. Gordy's backstory was that he wanted to play basketball more than anything, but he wasn't tall enough, and he was passed over 4 years in a row in Miles City, Montana. But he didn't quit. He kept practicing in the summer before he enrolled at the University of Minnesota. He grew 6 inches. He not only made the varsity as a walk-on, he became the starting center. As the best game came on the biggest stage, Madison Square Garden. World War II came along, and Gordy became a dive bomber in the Pacific. He was fearless. I can't tell you how inspirational Gordy was for this 21-year-old aspiring journalist. I'm so honored that Gordy's family is here tonight. Thank you so much for coming. When I was 26, I had my dream job. I was sports editor of the Billings, but after 5 years, I was second-guessing myself. I had my dream job, but would I look back in 10 to 15 years and regret that I had played it safe? I walked away from that job. My parents and Gordy thought I was crazy, but I wanted to be challenged. I went to Europe and burned through my life savings in 3 months. By day, I toured every art museum and cathedral. At night, I slept on trains and woke up in a new city every day. On the train ride back to Montana, I impulsively took a detour. I got off the train in Lima, Ohio, and hitchhiked 2 hours. In December, I went to Cincinnati to see a friend who worked at the Associated Press. Talk about great timing. 3 months later, I was working for the AP in Cincinnati. Thanks to Bill Winter and Paul Freeman, I was covering Pete Rose and Johnny Bench and the legendary Reds team. So, right here, how Ron Clark is covering Pete Rose and Johnny Bench and the legendary Reds team. This is why, this is Johnny Bench's candidate. It revolves around Norm Clark. So, Johnny Bench is obviously great, but it's a lesser figure here. And his candidacy, Norm Clark, is, I'd say, more outstanding in this second, in this time period. Let me get backtrack a minute. And when I was a newspaper boy, I carried a big stick with me. I'd use it to defend myself from the occasional cranky dog. As I mentioned, I love sports, especially the Olympics. With that stick in my hand, I found myself on cold wintry nights drawing the Olympic rings in the snow. So a decade into my AP career, I got a call from sports editor Byron Yates. He offered me the job of the AP's coordinator of coverage of the 1984 Los Angeles Summer Olympics. Immediately, I thought of this Olympic rings I drew in the snow. Of course, I took the Olympic job, and halfway through them, I got a call from Denny Dressman with a job offer. Thank you, Denny. Would I head the Rocky Mountain News coverage of Denver's bid to get a Major League Baseball team? As soon as the Olympics ended, I joined the Rocky because by now, I knew I was just following my heart. I love the idea of birth of a Major League team, especially one in my home region. Being part of Denver's Wild West newspaper war also appealed to me. On June 4th, 1991, Rocky sports editor Barry Forbes, who is here tonight with his wife Michelle, was convinced the story wouldn't last another 24 hours. He said, "We've got to have it today." My first call was to a big league manager, Mountain Hall of Fame. I had developed what I thought was a solid relationship with him. Jeff Denver has, which has certainly helped. I reached him at the ballpark before a night game. He delivered what I needed. He said Denver was in him. His GM had told him the day before. That was the first of five confirmations. The clincher came as deadline neared. I reached a high-level baseball executive and the majority of owners were convinced. Denver is the shortest name there is. That was exclamation point to the most stressful day and most important story of my career. The proud family moment of my career came in January 1981. AP had assigned me to the homecoming of the 52 U.S. hostages, who held captive 14 and a half months by Iranians. I flew from San Diego with the family of one of the hostages. When I arrived at the AP command post outside West Point, I was handed one of those huge walkie-talkies and given my assignment. I was paired by Peter Arnett, AP's Pulitzer Prize-winning battlefield reporter, later a superstar at CNN. I joined him at the secondary security fence near the tarmac, where the hostages would first set foot on American soil. The head of AP's coverage team called Arnett and said they needed him to go live on radio as soon as the planes landed. He respectfully declined. He was doing the lead story. He didn't want to miss anything. He said, "I'm going to send Norm Clark." He must have seen a little panic in my eyes because he said, "We'll be fine." I called my mother in Montana that night. She was so excited. She said she was driving along the Yellowstone River when a report came on that the hostages were finally home safe and America was rejoicing. Then she heard her son. Reporting from the scene, she said, "I was so proud that I nearly dropped off the road. Those words have stayed with me for a lifetime. I wish I could say my entire career was filled with proud moments. Like, that's not exactly true. In retrospect, maybe I should have rephrased some questions. Every so often, maybe someone took offense to something that is not a short list. Rick Riley, the Runyon winner in 2009, told me, man, he got shot more than a blue baby. I was bitch slapped by Pete Rose and baseball commissioner Peter Ueberoth. In Cincinnati, there was a press box fistfight with a beat writer who called me Cyclops one time too many. More recently, there was an incident with magician Chris Angle who said if I wrote one more word about him, I would need two eye patches. But nothing quite compares to the near international incident during my LA Olympic assignment. I was invited to a British Olympic fundraising gala at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Prince Andrew was the featured speaker. I was also invited to attend a star-studded reception. A Buckingham Palace protocol official said Prince Andrew would not be attending it. But in the event, I met him. I could only speak to him if he addressed me. I could only shake his hand if he offered his. The reception was winding down. I needed more quotes regarding Prince Andrew. And I saw two attractive young ladies in the VIP crowd, and it occurred to me they might be the friends of Randy Andy. Well, their faces lit up with excitement as I started to introduce myself. Then I realized they were acknowledging someone next to me. I turned, and there was Prince Andrew. He was offering me a handshake. As I was shaking his hand, I identified myself, thinking that was proper protocol. Norm Clark, the Associated Press. He said, "Press?" I said, "Yes, the Associated Press, Los Angeles Bureau." Like that, I would make any damn bit of difference then. It didn't. Out. You are not welcome here. I stood my ground and said, "I was told you were not attending the reception. Your people said I was invited." "Out," he repeated. Then he grabs my lapel and says, "Hope I didn't get any on you yesterday." I realized he's referring to the incident when he obnoxiously spray-painted a group of reporters. I replied, "I wasn't there." He said, "A pity." And he walked away. Damon Runyon would have located the cast of characters I cover in Las Vegas, who would have had enough material for another Guys and Dolls. Speaking of dolls, my wife, Kara, is with me tonight, as she had been for the past 11 years. Denver holds a special place in our hearts. We met here. We got engaged here, and we love our many friends we have here. Kara's always been a political junkie while I normally stay away from politics. But when I got a tip that Steve Wynn and George Clooney had an epic blow-up over President Barack Obama, that got my interest. I put a call to Wynn, hoping he would confirm this much of it. I figured it might be a short conversation. Imagine my joy when he confirmed it, in all of its glorious detail. Wynn kept emphasizing to me that Clooney had 16 shots of tequila. He said it's so often that I actually believe he heard he had someone confirm it through surveillance video. I reached Clooney's publicist, told him what I had. He said he would get right back. But to be honest, I wasn't expecting any more than your basic no comment. So I was more than a little surprised. I was ecstatic once arrived from Clooney. He said Steve likes to go on rants. He said Wynn called the president an a-hole, and Clooney responded that the president was a longtime friend. Clooney admitted he called Wynn an a-hole, and he wasn't going to sit at Wynn's table if he was going to be a jackass. Wynn said Clooney F-bombed him while departing. Wynn added, clearly is fun to be with. When he's sober, you have a chance to drink with him, you want to get there early and not stay late. The story went viral, and I was interviewed by NBC's Today Show. I guess what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas is a cute little slogan, but it's no sure bet. Some stories stick with you forever. In November 1980, the phone rang in my San Diego condo. It was AP headquarters in New York. The MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas was on fire. The death toll could exceed 400. Get there as soon as possible. My gut reaction, I did not want to go through this again. 3 years earlier, I had covered the Beverly Hills Supper Club fire in Kentucky that killed 165 people. I was one of the first reporters at the fire, and I was still having nightmares over the horrific images. Reporters don't get to pick what they cover. You go. Because it's what we do. Many of us covered the fire for a week. There's so many remarkable stories of survival. One stood out. At the height of the fire, a cowboy was filmed escaping down a rope from the 14th floor. Others had leaped off the balcony to grab the rope, but couldn't hang on and fell to their deaths. The cowboy in the black hat became the symbol of the fire force, extraordinary will to live. Everybody wanted that interview. I tracked down Randy Howard the next day at his mother's home in Illinois. I got the number from a motel receptionist, and she just happened to be from Montana. Every year on November 21st, I wondered how much the fire had impacted Randy Howard's life. In 1999, I moved from Denver to Las Vegas, and occasionally let it be known in my column that I hope to reconnect with that cowboy someday. Left a couple messages, but no phone numbers. But he wasn't ready to relive it yet. Then one day, 28 years after the fire, I got an email that said, Randy Howard is ready to talk to you. Randy had even more jaw-dropping details this time. For instance, a week after the fire, a delivery truck pulled up in front of his Illinois home. He thought the truck was part of a ruse by the police to arrest him for his drug dealing. He ran out the back door. Turns out it was not the cops. The truck was over in one of the thousands of suitcases left in rooms at the MGM Grand. Inside Randy Howard's suitcases, everything he left behind. More than $100,000 in cash, his drugs, and a 357 Magnum. The MGM Grand placed a letter in the suitcase, invited him to come back someday, and added his room would be comped. And 28 years later, the MGM Grand, true to their word, comped his room. At the opposite end of the spectrum from Randy Howard is a Catholic nun named Sister Armida. In 1982, I was based in San Diego when Mexico's economy crashed. The peso was all but worthless. The Los Angeles AP Bureau sent me to Tijuana to find a story that reflected the impact of the peso's collapse. The search didn't take long. The photographer and I drove past a little non-descript building with a long line of people waiting to get in. I asked our interpreter what Casa de los Pobres meant. He said House of the Poor. With a little divine guidance, we found this tiny Catholic mission that was facing an immense challenge. Sister Armida was in charge, and when I asked her to describe the financial meltdown, her quote was, every day we have a river of people coming for food we don't have. We don't have money for coffee, so we just give them hot water from a little coffee pot, and for them, it is like soup. All right, since we have about 90 seconds left of the show, I'm going to give my franchise four, starting with Hank Aaron. Second, I have Barry Bonds. Third, I'm going to take, this is a tough one. I don't think Ricky Henderson, not good enough, but I'm going to go with, this is actually really hard right now. I'm going to go with Tom Seaver. And then for my final one, I'm going to go with, let's go with Pedro Martinez. So my franchise four, Hank Aaron, Barry Bonds, Pedro Martinez, Tom Seaver. Give your franchise four at MLB.MLB.com/MLB-events-all_star-y2015-franchise_4.jsp /C_ID=greatest_players. So my franchise four, put your franchise four in, block it before 11:59 p.m. tonight. All right, I'm Benson Vector. This is MLB Central. You can tune in Monday night for our next show. Have a great day.